To my regular crew, some of you will have heard bits and pieces of this because I'm pulling together a lot of things from a lot of sermons to make this. You will not have heard all of it. To most of you, you will have heard none of it. But this is what we're doing. Inevitably, at Easter, every year, news channels and documentaries come out talking about the new Gnostic gospel just found. Or why this didn't happen, or why Jesus isn't who he said, or Jesus wasn't even a man of history. And we just get bombarded by a bunch of junk. And it looks like they choose Easter to just really try to dampen everything. And all these new challenging discoveries, they're not really new. They're all recycled with a new face. But whether they're new or old, the problem is that we as Christians would easily dismiss them, except for one problem. Most of us don't know scriptures well enough, don't know why we believe what we believe well enough to refute these things. So every time something comes out on the news, every time a friend has to come to you and tell you why they don't believe, it puts you in a frenzy and in a moment of doubt, and you begin to question everything about your faith. Well, actually, we're not alone. I want to let you see this, and it's so sad, and then we're going to jump right into it. So I'm not going to try to make a lesson out of this, but I want you to see where we are as a nation. There's a man by the name of Dr. Kenneth Birding. He's a professor of Beulah Talbot School of Theology, and he talked to the Christian Post not long ago, and this was his comment. All the research indicates that biblical literacy in America is at an all-time low. Fear that although the U.S. Christian movement may appear strong, particularly to someone overseas, the foundation is crumbling largely because of, listen, a lack of engagement and submission to the Bible. The building hasn't come down yet, but the next strong wind might just do the job. And this is what he's got to base it on. Anybody have a Lifeway Bible? Anybody ever heard of Lifeway? Big agency. They've got a Lifeway Research Center. They've done research. And this, actually, it didn't shock me, but it's scary numbers. In the churches across America, people that say they love God and they're in church, 45% of those regularly attending church, regular attenders, read the Bible more than once a week. 40% of the people attending read their Bibles occasionally, maybe once or twice a month, if at all. And 18% of attenders, regular attenders, say they never read their Bible. Well, that'd be a field day for me, wouldn't it? I can just tell you what I wanted. That's the problem. Some are. That's the problem when you talk to people and they talk you under the table and you see all these documentaries and you live in a crisis of faith all the time. So, if we knew what we're supposed to know, the world's accusations and these crazy stories wouldn't be left unopposed. And one of the biggest things that I feel like I need to do today, because I don't think anyone should accept faith in Jesus Christ unless you first can believe intellectually. Because if you just believe emotionally, if you just want to, you just have to grasp that faith. You just got to believe. Well, then why aren't you Islamic? Why aren't you atheist? As long as you believe in it with all you got, go party. So you shouldn't be blind in your faith. You better doggone know why you believe. And that's why I love Christianity. There is no doubt to the open investigator why you should believe what you believe. So what I want to do this Easter is I want to take all the proof that's out there for why you should believe. For those of you that don't know what to believe, for those of you that are living on the edge in your belief and no one around you knows it, for those of you that have believed for years but you don't quite have a solid foundation, I want us to see, and I want to take a look at some of the most critical points of the story of Christ, of the Easter story, the critical points that are attacked every year. And I want to see how they would hold up with pure evidence in a court of law. If you were to put Jesus on trial, what would it say? What would you be able to prove or disprove? None of this, well, you just got to have faith. Well, if I've got a big God and he's lived since time eternal, he probably left some pretty good fingerprints along the way. Amen? You shouldn't have to guess whether he's real. So, my gosh, the best, most awesome thing we could do at Easter Resurrection Day is to tell you why we know that we know that we know The resurrection's real. So that's what we're going to cover. This is what we're going to cover today. Number one, are the scriptures that tell the story of Jesus even accurate after all these years? These are some of the things I've covered in whole sermons before. I'm going to give tidbits and pull it all together for the court case today. All right? So some of you will have heard some, but not all. And some of you are going to hear this for the first time and be blown away because it's awesome. One, are the scriptures even accurate? I mean, I hear so many people say, why do you even believe in scriptures? They're thousands of years old. What you've got probably doesn't even have the same words in it that were originally written, not even the same concept. Well, let's find out. Number two, was Jesus even a real person that lived on earth, or was he a made-up figure for religious fanatics? That's majorly in question. Entire documentaries all over TV about it. Number three, if he was real, how do you know he was really crucified? A lot of people say he lived a long life. He got married to Mary. The Islamic faith says he never died by crucifixion at all. Many, many people say, yeah, he lived, but he didn't die. And if he did get crucified, how do you know he died? How do you know he didn't swoon? How do you know he didn't live through it? How do you know they didn't crucify somebody else? And if he did get crucified and he did die, how on earth can you give me something, Doug, for a solid court case 2,000 years later that he resurrected? I'm going to question Dayasan. Today, we find an answer, and it's going to shock you. So I want you to hold on, and we're going to walk through it. And I'm going to go on and jump right into it because you get an idea of what we're going to do, and we've got some awesome stuff to cover, and I want to have time to talk it through right. Okay? So court is in session, and I'm going to ask you something. I'm going to try to be decent on the time, but what you hear today might be one of the most important things you ever hear your whole life. So please, if you have to ask your spouse to pinch you or smack you in the back of the head to keep you totally alert, you listen to what's said today. Not because I'm preaching, I could give a hoot, but listen to the evidence. It's awesome. Okay? Exhibit A. The offender, Jesus of Nazareth. The offense, he claims to be the Son of God. And the victims that are hurt by this are usually the unlearned or those that don't care. Because if you do learn and you do care, you're not hurt by it. You're amazed. But that's the court case. Our first piece of evidence, Exhibit A, we have to prove the certainty of Scripture. Does it have integrity? Does it have the right content? How does the Bible, listen, this is the question, how does the Bible stand against the truthworthiness, thank you, of other ancient manuscripts? Ancient manuscripts that are of the same age. Is it proven? Is it acceptable? Is what you have in your hands something that you can trust, or is it just so far from the original that it's pitiful? Is that not the perfect place to start? Because if we don't get something established there, why should we go on? Right? So that's the first question. I'm going to tell you this right off the bat. Whether the world likes it or not, the New Testament can be placed against any evidential criteria used to judge all other ancient manuscripts and come out with rainbows flashing above it. It's awesome. By far, it passes all the tests that all secular and Christian people have ever put it against, that they use against all other ancient manuscripts. It has exceeded every other book that's ever been tested. No one that is a true historian will refute that. It's the unlearned people that try to say, oh, what you got in your hand, you don't know what it is. No, a true historian will never say that to you. And that's the truth. You can look it up. And I challenge you, anybody that's here that's new that does not know me, you should not take my word for it. I'm a bald-headed old rickety preacher that might not know my head from a hole in the ground. You go and you let this light enough fire to examine everything I tell you on your own and see what you find. Okay? Now, here we go. First of all, the New Testament was written approximately between A.D. 50 and A.D. 90. A.D. 90 being the absolute latest date that any part of it was written. Okay? One copied portion of the book of John has actually been found to date back to 125 A.D. A copy of the original book of John was found as having been written in A.D. 125. So, that means the first copy of the book of John was found just 35 years after the event occurred. Okay? No one questions that. Anything I'm telling you is a fact. No, no one questions it, whether they're secular or Christian. Okay? So, now listen to me. I want you to follow this with me. If John had copies already circulating by 125 AD, and his was the latest one written, how many copies of all the Gospels were already circulating everywhere by 125? Now, there are total, complete, and authentic copies. Listen to this, and I want you to look it up if you don't believe me. Total and authentic copies of every single book in the New Testament found within 250 years of their time being written. Did you hear that? I want you to listen close. Every copy of the New Testament, every book has a legitimate copy found written within 250 years of the original time in which it transpired and was originally recorded. This is why that's important. Are you ready? That's about how far away we find the first copy of parts of the New Testament. Let's go and find all other ancient documents, all, and find the next best case. How far was it from the original to the next copy? Well, let's do this. Whee! 1,000 years is the earliest, 1600, 2500, and on from there. The top three were 1,000, 1600, and 2500 years. Between when the original was written and when they found the first copy. And yet nobody questions those in the big universities. But when you have maximum 250 years between any and all books of the New Testament, suddenly we question how could they be authentic? There's a little bit of bias there, do you think? Now, this is even more awesome. If you're listening, say amen. All right. There are 5,300 known original Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Got it? If you add to that all the ancient copies found in all the languages, ancient manuscripts that you can find in archaeology, guess how many we have? New Testament copies found in all languages, ancient manuscripts, over 24,000. Now, listen to me. If you go back again and look at all the other ancient copies of all other secular texts and find the best one that has the most copies, guess what the next best runner-up is? Best comparison? 643. 643 versus over 24,000 ancient manuscripts. Now, let me tell you why that is special. Put on your thinking caps a minute. First of all, you have very early copies in large numbers, and if you have a very early copy, the one that copied it was there when the original occurred, so they know whether it was true, and also they've got very good manuscript to copy from, guaranteeing you've got a beautiful rendition of what was originally said. Okay? Number two, listen close to this. You want to wonder, do we have what they wrote then? Well, number one, early is good, but if you have 24,000 manuscripts in all kinds of languages all over the ancient world. And I decide, you know, I want to go and I want to alter this New Testament thing. I don't like this Jesus cult, and I'm going to alter the New Testament a little bit and mess with them. So I'm going to get just a few of my friends, and we're going to travel all over the continent and find all 24,000 copies in their original language, and we're going to change them all to match each other. That's what I would have to do if I wanted to mess with it. That's why it's so awesome. Listen to me. The way the Gospels exploded in the beginning, you got, in just the first few hundred years, 24,000 copies in multiple languages. It was irreversible. The explosion could not be reversed. The manuscripts could never be changed at that point, because we can pull from all the ancient manuscripts and all the languages, and guess what they do? One, they agree with each other. Two, they agree with what we have today. So how do you argue with 24,000 exact copies? You don't. You know what you have to conclude on that? We have what they had then. There is no way to refute that looking at historical, logical evidence. None. If so, you would have to burn every historical document we have 50 times over, because none of them will pass that test. They won't come close. Do I get a little excited about this? Yes. One, because it's exciting. Two, because I get tired of it being refuted by ignorance or prejudice. You need to know. And people get hurt when they're lied to, right? you need to know. All right. Now, this is what, listen to this, Mr. Sir Frederick Kenyon is the former director and principal librarian of the British Museum. Okay, not a Southern Baptist convention leader. All right. This is what he is one of the greatest authorities in the field of New Testament textual criticism. This is what he says. He sums it up for me so I don't have to. It cannot be too strongly asserted that in substance, the text of the Bible is what, class? Certain. Especially is this the case with the New Testament. The number of manuscripts of the New Testament, of early translations from it, and of quotations from it in the oldest writers of the church is so large that it's practically certain that the true reading of every doubtful passage is preserved in someone or other of these ancient authorities. This can be said of no other book in the what? Here's what he's also saying. He's saying so many writers, and we do it today too, so many writers have quoted from the Bible in their writings that you could do away with the Bible and you could rewrite it from the quotings of ancient manuscripts. You got that? Not only do we have 24,000 original manuscripts, but we also have so many quotes we could reconstruct it from ancient books of other types. Holy moly! What else do you need? What we have in our hands is what they wrote. Okay? Hands down. I'll leave you with this one and we'll move on. And the last foundation for any doubt that Scripture has come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. All right. Now on top of that, you want to go to 90% of all archaeological discoveries have been basically in our life, and yet not one can refute the Bible. Not one can refute the Bible, and yet the Bible is proven again and again by archaeology. A good archaeologist keeps a Bible under his arm, whether he believes it or not, because it's trustworthy. Okay? So, in short, piece of evidence number one, whether you agree or whether you disagree with the gospel story of the New Testament, is beside the point. You can confidently say to any honest skeptic, it is an accurate account of what was written. You don't have to guess, was it an accurate account? Now we'll go from there and prove whether it was right, okay? But the foundation, the evidence is in. There is no way a court of law could say in any way that we don't have an established fact that the gospels we have are what were written. Square number one. So let's bring in exhibit. Now, a lot of people here, right there is big news. You didn't know it. And yet it's blatantly there for anybody to find. Will the media tell you that? Will you get that on MSNBC? Will you get that on an awesome documentary on Discovery Channel? No. But the research is there. They just don't want you to hear it. All right. Exhibit B. Jesus Christ is a man of history. Now, scriptures we have in our hand are not altered. But does that mean the stories are true? Does it still prove Jesus was even real? Just because the Bible said so. There were a lot of fanatics that wrote the Bible. It might be an accurate fanatical tale, right? All right. Well, the biggest thing we need to look at there, if you want to say, was Jesus a man of history? We're going to have to look at something besides the Bible because you're not going to believe the Bible anyway. A lot of people aren't. And how can I just use the Bible to prove something if it's all religious fanatics? First of all, I want you to look at this. A lot of people don't realize it. The Encyclopedia Britannica, this is what they say about Jesus. Over 20,000 words about him. That's a lot of words for a man that doesn't exist. But here's what it says. These independent accounts, prove that in ancient times, even the opponents of Christianity never doubted the historicity of Jesus. Which was disputed for the first time on inadequate grounds by several authors at the end of the 18th, during the 19th, and the beginning of the 20th century. So the Encyclopedia says Christ was always an indisputable fact up until recently. Has anybody ever seen on Netflix Zeitgeist? That plus many other programs, oh, they give you this awesome documentary of how Jesus was a myth and built on previous religions. It is the biggest load of hogwash you will ever see in your life. It is laughable if you've studied anything about history. So, but it hurts people. And I've had people come, you don't know how many people have come to me about Zeitgeist and all this documented evidence. Well, they don't give you any documentation. They just give you an awesome story. Go back and check where the facts lead you. don't just follow like some puppy dog. What we're going to do, all right, the encyclopedia said independent accounts. Let's go back and see what those independent accounts are. Man, it ought to be scattered all over history. Something as big as a man like Jesus who split history, everybody ought to have been writing about him, right? Well, let's see what history says. All right, here we go. That'll bring us to Exhibit C, which is detailed documentations of his death. Now listen to this. You've heard the Islamic faith. What we're going to do, we're going to prove he was a man of history, and we're going to prove about his death, when he died, and how he died, all in one shot. And this is just like it was in a court of law. I don't need your faith at this point. Okay? Would like to have it before the end? That's between you and God. I'm just going to give you the facts. All right? Islamic faiths say he wasn't crucified. The Gnostic Gospels say he wasn't crucified. Many people say he didn't even exist, much less crucified. What does real history say? Get rid of the Christian stuff. Get rid of those fanatics. What's really in history? Now, this is pretty awesome. I don't like it. Some people will acknowledge this. They'll say, okay, yeah, he was a man of history, but have you heard this? He was just a good man. He was a great teacher, and he probably didn't die on the cross, and if he did, he just did it as a good man. Well, that's not a problem at all, except that it destroys the whole reason he came to earth. It takes away your salvation. It discredits Jesus as God, and it destroys the Gospels and the Scriptures. Other than that, it's a great story. So when somebody wants to meet you in the middle and say, yeah, he was a man of history, and that's it, give me a break. That's Satan's biggest deal. Let me give you just enough of a nugget to make you shut up. And it's just blasphemy, okay? You don't have to accept that, because all the way is proven. Here we go. Things other than the Gospels. Now, this one is rocking. I want you to look at this. Even if you've heard this before, you better get excited with me, because I do every time I cover it. Beriah. These are writings of the Sanhedrin. Anybody have any idea what the Sanhedrin is? The Sanhedrin is the highest court of law in the Jewish culture in Jesus' day. Made up by Pharisees and Sadducees of about 70 people. It was the high court. Now, not only was it a high court with lots of documentation that has been kept frugally, beautifully, but this, the entire Sanhedrin hated him. Guess who was responsible for killing him? Guess who would love for you to never know his name? Would love for you to never think he ever existed in history? The Sanhedrin. That's called a hostile witness. If a hostile witness, one that would like to spit at the truth, has to admit it, that's a pretty good witness in court, right? Okay. These guys hated him. These guys lived when he did, during his time, contemporary with him. These guys killed him. These guys' records were legal records kept in a legal fashion. They weren't allowed to be messed with. Okay? Here's what they say. On the eve of Passover, they hanged Yeshua. What's his real name? Yeshua. Yeshua of Nazareth. But they found naught in his defense and hanged him on when? The eve of Passover. When they say hanged, they didn't hang people by a newsstand. That means they hung him on a cross. They hanged Yeshua on the eve of Passover. Wow. All right? Now, these are people that hated him. These are people that lived when he lived, saw him. This is an eyewitness account from a hostile witness. In a court of law, they would back up and regroup and say, hey, we better consider that one. Okay? But that's just the beginning. Look at this one. Lucian of, say it with me, Samosata. He's a satirist. He's a mocking, abusive writer. He's like a mean comedian today. Okay? You'd see him on The Tonight Show or something. Okay. He hated Christ, hated Christianity, hated anything to do with Christ, but he was a satire writer. He was a historian. He wrote just shortly after the time of Christ. This is what he wrote about Christ. Now tell me if he's writing because he loves Christ and wants to turn you into a Christian. The man who was crucified in Palestine because he introduced this new cult into the world. Furthermore, their first lawgiver persuaded them that they were all brothers, one of another, after they transgressed once for all by denying the Greek gods and by worshiping that crucified sophist himself and living under his laws. Oh my gosh, it sounds like he loved him. Right? Can you tell that's a little hostile? But can you tell that he obviously knew what he was talking about? He knew Jesus was alive. He knew Jesus was crucified. He knew Jesus was worshipped. Oh, but Jesus isn't a man of history. Jesus wasn't crucified. Give me a break. All right, let me give you another one. Flavius Josephus, look at when he was born, AD 37. He's right on the heels, baby. Okay? That would be like me telling you the Vietnam War happened. He was a Jewish historian. He was a Pharisee. He was a commander in the Jewish forces. This is what he wrote. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. Excuse me. He drew over to him both many Jews and many Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. Wow. One, he was an awesome man. Two, he was crucified. Three, he was crucified under Pilate. Four, those that saw him die wouldn't abandon him even after they saw him die. Written by a man that was born 3 or 4 years after Jesus died. I'm thinking he talked to eyewitnesses. I'm thinking he saw the people that killed him. I'm thinking it was the biggest talk when he was alive there ever was. Do you think he could have written about it if it didn't happen? No. So we've seen people that hated him, that probably were involved in killing him, that were part of a big legal system right about him. And we've now seen this man who had to be trusted. He was a Jewish historian, Pharisee, and a commander of Jewish forces. All right about Jesus. All contemporaries. One more, and we'll move on. Justin Martyr. He was a well-educated philosopher. Now listen to his words. Are you ready? But the words, they pierced my hands and my feet, are a description of the nails that were fixed in his hands and his feet on the cross. And after he was crucified, those who crucified him cast lots for his garments and divided them amongst themselves. That these things were so, you may learn from the acts which were recorded under Pontius Pilate. Look at me. This man said, one, he was crucified. Two, they cast lots for his clothing under his cross. Not only was that written about in the New Testament, but it was written about in the Old Testament hundreds, thousands of years before he was born. And yet this man says, not only did I see it, but if you don't believe me, go to Pontius Pilate and ask him to let you spend a little time in his records. Because he's got official records. And if you don't believe me, go look it up. That would be like me telling you, hey, go on down to Charleston and go in the courthouse and ask them to let you check out Jesus of Nazareth. Because they killed him a couple years ago and all the records are right there about his death. That would be pretty brazen if it wasn't true, wouldn't it? So he confirms prophecy from the Old Testament. He confirms everything the New Testament said. And then he says, I don't want you to believe me. Go to the courthouse, yo. How much more evidence do you need? And then the last thing he says is this, just to throw it in there and twist the knife, that he performed these, what, class? Miracles. You may be easily satisfied from the acts of Pontius Pilate. He said, oh yeah, by the way, he also did some things we can't explain. I don't know what to tell you, but I just know they happened. Go check out the original documents. And what I want you to see is he says the acts of who? Pontius Pilate. Was Pontius Pilate a Jew? Was he a religious man? So if Pontius Pilate records that crazy, miraculous things were done by this man, you better doggone believe it. It had nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with a cult, nothing to do with fake faith. It had to do with Pontius Pilate's legal record saying this man did some unexplainable things. Did you know that was part of history? Did you know those things were written? Do you hear about that on the news? Do you get to see documentaries about that? This is truth. And you can look these sources up in ancient documents. You don't have to trust somebody on MSNBC or Zeitgeist. All right, so he was a real figure in history. And he was crucified under the reign of a Roman leader named Pontius Pilate, established completely in history and archaeology. So there's another piece of evidence that you do not have a single crack in the door to try and beat in a court of law. Most people in here will already have been left behind in, I didn't know that. And it's a shame that we don't know that. But the world will hide it from us. Now, Exhibit D, medical and historical crucifixion. There are claims that he was crucified, but that he could not have died and risen again. So one, here's what I have to prove to you. One, his body couldn't have been taken by disciples. Two, he couldn't have just swooned and been brought back to life so people could see him later. Okay? Those are the two only possibilities. If he did live, if he did get crucified, but we've seen him again, which I'll talk about in a minute, there's only two options. Either he faked it or his body was stolen. Okay? So, we're going to take a look at that evidence and see what we got. Let's examine first whether he could have survived the crucifixion. All right? We're going to use archaeological, historical, and medical evidence. We're going to look at the physical trauma of Jesus through this and the documentation. Please focus with me. Number one, this is going to show you something amazing. And number two, it's going to make you appreciate how much Jesus Christ loves you. Okay? The physical trauma of Jesus Christ starts, of all places, in the Garden of Gethsemane. The aspect of suffering starts powerfully with something we usually overlook. Bloody sweat. The physician, Luke, is the only one that mentions this. And this is what he says, and I did not mean to go forward. I'm going to back you up one. Luke 22:44. Being in agony, not physical agony. Well, it was physical, but it wasn't because something had happened. Jesus was praying, and he was in agony because of what he was about to go through. Not just the physical torment he knew was coming, but the fact that he knew the Father was going to have to turn his back on him, that he was going to have to become sin, that he would have to be hated and die alone. And there's a very rare phenomenon called hemothidrosis, bloody sweat. It's well documented. Under great times of stress, usually in warfare, many, many tiny capillaries under the skin will break. They're little beady ones, and it'll mix in with the pores. And then when you sweat, you will sweat that blood from those tiny capillaries, and you will literally sweat blood with your sweat. What this means in trauma is that he is already in shock from the extreme emotional stress. That is a very powerful sign. He's in extreme shock. His body is already extremely weakened, probably dehydrated, and in shock. Left untreated, he could already die. Now, that's before anything even starts. And then he's brought before the Sanhedrin, the high court, and Caiaphas, the high priest, and he's blindfolded. Now, I want us to stop just for a minute. And I'm going to throw this one in there just on the logical assumption that I'm going to tell you he's the Son of God. If he is the Son of God, and he has all power, everything he's getting ready to go through at any time, God the Father would let him. And I know this for a fact, because Jesus said, "Do you not know at any time I could call down my angels?" At any given time, Jesus Christ could say, "No game. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to come home. They're not worth it." And he could have wiped us out, stopped it, reversed it, killed everybody. He took this in humility and became a worm for us. He was brought, he was blindfolded, he was taunted and mocked. People cleared their throat and spit in his face. He had his beard pulled out. He was beaten repeatedly in the face so badly he swelled up beyond recognition. And this is, if you can grasp that this is God, that, if we stop right there, should blow your mind. That God would allow himself to become a man and be beaten and spit upon by scum and take it in love. And the next morning, after being beaten and bruised and dehydrated and in a state of shock, Pilate ordered the release of a criminal named Barabbas and condemned Jesus to death by scourging and crucifixion. If you've never heard about these things that I'm getting ready to talk about, please listen. Well documented. Crucifixion is the most cruel and torturous death that they had back then, and one of the worst you could ever endure. Flavius Josephus wrote this: an entire barrack of soldiers, tough soldiers, surrendered with the pledge that when they would be killed, and they would be killed for whatever they had done, when they were killed, they wouldn't be crucified. I don't care. Whatever else you do, we'll turn ourselves in now without a fight. We know you're going to kill us. Just don't crucify us. We'll go ahead and turn ourselves in. It was so horrible, Roman citizens were excluded. Joel M. Donahoe has done massive amounts of research, historically, archaeologically, and he's produced one of the most authentic replicas of what they used back then, called a Roman flagrum. And this is the quote he gives. He spent much time studying exactly what happens during this scourging. Okay, this instrument was used with the purpose of bringing the accused of the threshold to death. Whatever you're doing or thinking right now, stop and listen to this. God Himself endured what I am getting ready to tell you. Okay? In the first century, a Roman scourging was referred to as the sting of the scorpion, done with a particular scourging implement called the scorpion, which was embedded with nails, sharp scraps of bone from the forehead of a ram, heavy circles of bronze and lead. Often the thongs ended with metal fish hooks, spurred, that would catch on the skin and pull large strips of flesh, muscle, and fragments of bone. Most of the time, the bare rib bones of the victim and the spine would show through. You think this is an exaggeration? Listen to history. First century, Josephus. Certain rebel Jews were torn to pieces, quoting, by scourge before being crucified. Quoting historian Eusebius Caesare. Whew. Their bodies were frightfully... This is a quote from someone who saw a scourging. Their bodies were frightfully lacerated. Christian martyrs in Smyrna were so torn by the scourges that their veins were laid bare, and their inner muscles and their sinews, even entrails, were exposed. Going back to Mr. Donahoe, quotes on how it would happen. They would take the whip. This is an exact quote from how he was doing a demonstration. They would take the whip and they would hit it above the shoulders. Listen close. They would strike like this, and he's showing. They would hit with the back, then they would yank the whip down, and it would start to unravel the skin on the back of the prisoner in strips. It would just peel it off. Not cuts. It would literally tear the flesh off in strips. Dr. Truman Davis wrote this. Finally, the skin on the back would be hanging in long ribbons, and the entire area would be an unrecognizable mass of torn, bleeding tissue. When it's determined by the centurion in charge that the prisoner is near death, the beating finally stops. Now, when you hear scriptures from this point on, Matthew 26:28, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. The word shed there is ekeo, and it means to pour, gush out, run greedily, spill. So when you hear that phrase and you know it means to pour and gush out, when he's not talking about, oh, some blood trickled from my brow, he's talking about, you can see my spine and intestines from the strips of flesh hanging off my back. And the blood that is gushing and pouring out, that's the blood that's the blood of the testimony. That's what Jesus Christ went through as God. A certainty of death historically and medically? Well, let's go back to Donahoe for just a minute. A Roman scourging was considered a long and slow death penalty for which only the gods could save the victim. The victim usually died in 2 to 3 days from blood loss and infection if that was all that was done. The Romans were known at times to dip their whips in fresh goat's blood to ensure and hasten the infection process. A victim who was sentenced to a scourging had very little to no chance of survival, even if still alive by the end of the scourging. Blood loss and infection to come would result in certain death of the victim. Crucifixion to follow a scourging just served to expedite the victim's death by suffocation. In other words, as bad as crucifixion was, it was almost a blessing. Flavius Josephus recorded that 3 of his friends were crucified by the Romans, and they found out they shouldn't have been crucified, and as soon as they put them up, they took them down, like minutes. 2 of the men out of 3 died anyway. They had only been on the cross for a couple of minutes. and 2 out of 3 of them had already died. Jesus, on the other hand, was in shock before it started. He was beaten till he was unrecognizable. He was scourged until his flesh was torn open and you could see his bones and you could see his organs. He suffered massive blood loss and dehydration, shock. And then in that condition, he was given patibulum, the cross section of the cross, which weighed between 75 and 125 pounds. Now imagine having to walk a mile carrying 75 to 125 pounds on your back. Now imagine doing it while you're in shock and you've lost massive amounts of blood and there is no skin on your shoulders or on your back or on your chest or on your ribs and you've been beaten till you can't see through the slits in your eyes and you're already so messed up that you're sweating blood. And now you're going to carry 125 pounds a mile. No wonder he couldn't do it. No wonder they had to get somebody to carry it for him. He already was close to death. Finally, he's crucified. Crucifixion is designed to make someone be on the edge of asphyxiation and then come back, and then be on the edge and then come back for long periods of time. Back to Dr. Truman Davis. Hours of limitless pain, cycles of twisting, joint rendering cramps, intermittent partial asphyxiation, searing pain as tissue is torn from his lacerated back as he moves up and down the rough timber. Then another agony begins. A deep crushing pain in the chest as the pericardium slowly fills with a serum that's beginning to compress the heart. The compressed heart is struggling to pump heavy, thick, sluggish blood because he's dehydrated into the tissues. The tortured lungs are making a frantic final effort to gasp in small amounts of air. This markedly dehydrated tissue sends their flood of stimuli to the brain. And then finally, mercifully, Jesus would die. Either from hypovolemic shock, which is a rapid fluid loss, which makes all of his organs fail, or from exhaustion asphyxia, because what happens is, when you're hanging on the cross and the full weight is on your arms, you can't exhale. So you have to push up on the nails on your feet so you can exhale and take in another breath. So you do that until you're so exhausted you can't do it anymore. Until it hurts so bad you can't do it anymore. Then you can't rise back up. And then you get partially asphyxiated and you go numb and you can push up again and take another breath. And it goes on like this in limitless cycles for hours. Or lastly, it could have been congestive heart failure with fluids around the heart. Now, I want you to listen. We're back to the court of law. I've shown you what he had to go through to bring you to this point. To be certain Jesus was dead, a legionnaire took a spear and drove it through his chest. If anybody remembers what happened, it resulted in blood and water coming out. This is, in a court of law, a completely conclusive post-mortem evidence that he didn't die of suffocation, that he died of heart failure, because the heart had been constricted by fluid. And for him to have blood and water spill from his heart when it was punctured, it means that he had already died and the fluid had filled around his heart. It's a medical and historical guarantee that the victim had expired. There's even more than that. But if you just went strictly by the medical evidence, the fact that blood and water poured from his heart when it was pierced shows that he was already medically dead before he was pierced. No way around it. But let's go on. Clearly, the weight of historical and medical evidence indicates Jesus was dead before the wound to his side was inflicted and supports the traditional view that the spear thrust between his right rib probably perforated not only the right lung but also the pericardium and the heart, thereby ensured his death. Dr. Davis. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. Whether we knew the people writing this knew what that water and blood meant or not, they documented what they saw. We now know medically what it meant. But now let's go beyond that. You're in Rome. You've just executed somebody. You haven't just executed somebody. You've executed somebody that is the biggest story of the century, that has caused a rebellion to show up in Jerusalem that could cause Pontius Pilate to be put to death by Caesar because of the uprising. If this man were to show his face again, all hell would break loose. Not to mention it's the biggest story of history. These Roman guards that executed him had their very life at stake when they made mistakes. Are you with me? Guess how many people in a Roman crucifixion had to verify that he was dead? Four. Four people in the Roman government, four people medically responsible had to go and evaluate the body, and four people had to say he was dead. After being scourged, after being crucified, after being pierced through the heart and having water and blood pour out, then they laid him on the ground and had four people say, "Yep, he's dead." And they had to sign the death warrant. And if they messed up, it ain't good. So, that takes us to here. Exhibit E, historical proof of the resurrection. We know he lived. We know he was crucified. We know who he was crucified by. We know there is no way he could have lived through that. So if he was resurrected, only one of two things could happen. It was real, and he is the Son of God. Or somebody stole that body. Right? We show he couldn't have just walked away. He couldn't have just swooned. That's just pretty dumb. And if you think that's what happened, then let's just all get together as a congregation and beat you 39 times till we can see your organs. And let's hang you on a cross, and then let's stab you through the heart with a spear, and then let's put you in a tomb for 3 days, and let's see how you do. So now we're down to two things in our court. He was real. It happened. He was crucified. There's no way he lived through it. We got all kinds of evidence. We're down to the final testimony. Did he arise, or was his body stolen? Now, how on earth can you show any evidence that Jesus arose from the dead 2,000 years later? All right, let's take a look. The men in the pages of the New Testament say it. They say the tomb was empty. They make powerful claims, listen to this, concerning the resurrection that embarrassed the most powerful government, the most powerful fighting force on the planet, and just about in history, the Roman government. They make fun of the Roman government by saying Jesus Christ was out of the grave. They embarrass the Roman government. All right, in order to steal Jesus' body, let's go back into some history, and I want you to see what this really would have been like. Because it's so easy to say 2,000 years ago, well, if it wasn't there, it couldn't have been God. You know they had to steal the body. Well, do you have any idea what you're saying historically when you say that? Have you read anything? Do you understand what they were facing to be able to steal a body from the Roman government? Well, we did some research. Okay? Here's what it would take. Number one, the Roman seal. A Roman seal was put on and had to be broken for Jesus to get out of that tomb. And what that means is anyone who breaks the seal has an immediate, horrible death. You don't break the seal of the Roman government. Okay? Now, this is pretty awesome. I want you to listen to what I'm going to tell you here. Because this is true historical fact from the Roman Empire. That seal was guarded by an entire guard of the most well-trained men in history. Historian Dr. Paul Meyer writes that when guarding something outside of a prison in Rome, a Roman guard consisted of a minimum of 16. Did you get that number? Minimum of 16 of the best trained guards on the planet. Now, these 16 guards, 16, four of which were standing right there at any given time, and the other 12 laying about 10 feet away, sleeping with their feet in a circle and their heads to the outer perimeter so they can see and hear anything that comes in case the other four get killed. You with me? Rotating every 4 hours, another four fresh men. All day, all night, never stopping. But not only that, every one of them are under threat of death. If what they are guarding is stolen, every one of them is stripped naked and burned at the stake at a fire started with their own clothing. The alternative to that, if you don't like that one, is to be crucified upside down. That was the two ways a Roman guard who lost what he was guarding would be treated. 16 of the best soldiers around, guarding under threat of horrific death, and they just happened to be guarding the most crucial object that they had ever seen since they had been born. An object that could put down an uprising for the entire community. An uprising of hundreds of thousands of people. So, this is in the limelight. Okay? And the 16 number is minimal. That's the minimum they ever used. So guess what? In this circumstance, I would dare to say there was probably a lot more. Because they knew if this body were to disappear, oh my gosh, what would happen? All right. So, we've got Jesus laying in a tomb, has 16 trained soldiers under threat of death, guarding the most crucial object in the world, and I'm going to sneak past them, and I'm going to move that. Quietly! We don't want to wake up the 16 special forces guys over here! So, be careful moving that 2.5-ton rock. Are you beginning to see that this couldn't happen? Everything I'm giving you is historical evidence, not prejudice. Oh, well, he can't be the Son of God. Because if you don't want to accept the obvious, you got to come up with something. And I do understand that. But if you got to come up with something, you better do a better job than saying, well, they just had to steal his body. Because it ain't happening. So, that's pretty good evidence that nobody stole anything. And if you brought the evidence I just gave you to an honest court of law with a real jury and a real judge, do you think you could prove his body was stolen? No. 1 Corinthians 15:3. For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to Scriptures, that he was buried, that he rose again the third day according to Scriptures, and that he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12. After that, it was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present. But some have fallen asleep. After that, it was seen by James, then by all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen by me also, as by one born out of due time. Paul wrote this, and he says, by me also, as one born out of due time, is because Jesus made an appearance to him after he ascended into heaven, right? But did you see how many people he just listed? Now, this is awesome. Paul claims in that, number one, the vast majority of the people he's talking about. He said that the vast number of people I'm telling you that saw him, they're all still alive. You don't have to believe me. Just go talk to them. Okay? That's what he's saying first. He simply says, go ask. Now, if you take, he said over 500 people had seen Jesus at some time or another after he resurrected. So if you took 500 people and you just put each one on the stand for 5 minutes, you have 50 hours of testimony, eyewitness accounts of people that saw Jesus Christ after he arose. And you say, ah, they're all religious fanatics. Well, okay, number one, they all saw him at different times, different circumstances, under different conditions. So you can't say they all just got excited and fed off of each other and thought they saw something. No, there were many sightings to many different people in many different circumstances. Now here's the next thing. These people just didn't see some awesome, happy thing and decide to create a religion over it and live happily ever after. These people we're talking about that said they saw Jesus. Jesus was killed. Why? Because he was hated. So for them to say that they saw a resurrected Savior and won't recant on that, guess what was happening to them? Tortured. Killed. Property taken. Families torn apart. These weren't just people that came to church and said, hallelujah, praise God, we see Jesus. Pass me a hymnal. These were people that said, I saw Jesus, and they fell dead. There's a big difference in that testimony, right or wrong. Over 500 people said, yes, I saw Jesus, and met torture and death because they said it. Now, positive evidence comes from a case, again, where there's hostile sources. In other words, a source confirms a fact that they decidedly feel is not to their favor. But they all acknowledged that this was a fact. Listen to this. Listen. Jews of the religious sort that hated Jesus. Romans of the not religious sort that hated Jesus. All had documentation. All, listen, all acknowledged the tomb was empty in history. There is not one exception to that. All historical documents that we can find anywhere, Jewish or Roman, claim, yes, the tomb was empty. All they would need to do is go to a local tomb that was minutes from a community and produce one dead body of which they had guarded, of which they had. They tried for years through so much torture and death that their own soldiers got tired of doing it to put down the religion created by Jesus Christ. All they had to do was go back there in that tomb and pull out that rotting body and said, "Here's your crucified sophist. Shut up." Nobody could do it. Because history is at least honest in this point. And these are hostile witnesses. These are people that wanted to shut the Christians up. But they couldn't. They couldn't produce a body. Nobody in history produced a body of Jesus Christ. And then, when Christians and Jews and Romans all say the same thing, you better stand up and take some historical establishment over that. It's about like saying the Islamics and the Jews agree on something. If they both come up and agree on something, you better stop and look at it. It's big. Okay? But they all agreed on this fact. Scripture and secular historians tell us that a handful of the least likely men alive. Listen to this piece of evidence. Tax collectors of the day, fishermen, carried the story of a risen Savior. Listen, not years, not months, but a matter of days and weeks. Carried this story to the crowd that killed him, to the crowd that hated them, to the crowd that wanted to torture and kill them and often did. To the same crowd that had great knowledge, listen, of the events. The people that these originals talked to saw it all. They couldn't be bamboozled. This was the crowd that had the intellectuals of Judea. These were the teachers of the law. These were the same crowd that lived 15 minutes from the tomb. All they had to do was grab these disciples by the ear and drag them down the road and say, "Look and shut up. There's your tomb." Yet with all the knowledge of Scripture and of the events and of the tomb, this is where the disciples decided to start working. They were so confident. They were so energized. These people that hid out in an upper room came out screaming right there. They didn't decide to go off somewhere else. Right there where it all happened. Right there where they would catch hell on earth. Right there they had to rub the noses of those people in it and say, "All the stuff you saw that you tried to kill us over, well, do something now, bro." That's where they started. And this little group of people who believed a lie of a man that never existed, of whose body they stole just so they could have hundreds and even thousands killed and tortured to protect the fact that they stole a dead body and start a new religion when they already had a great one. So far, the story's really flying. Right? This band of unlearned peasants disrupted the whole Jewish world, the whole Roman world. In 20 years, it impressed every town in the Mediterranean area. In 50 years, threatened the whole peace of the Roman Empire, and eventually went on to split the entire world history in two eras. All because of a man that didn't exist, that's still laying in a tomb today. I'm saying they're not going to win this court case. And all these men died horrible deaths because of this resurrection. Why would they die a senseless, tortured death for a stupid lie? And if they could, and if they would, because they were such religious fanatics, do that, How could they go to the very society that saw it all happen and knew whether it was true or not? How could they convince literally hundreds and even thousands to die the same torturous death? How could you find that many religious fanatics? Do you think I could go out here and start a brand new religion that no one had ever heard of, based on nothing, and get 100,000 people in our local area to go get tortured deaths and have their family torn apart? And you're just going to take my word for it because you didn't see anything yourself. But yet you can just dismiss all of that and not count that as evidence. Let me tell you how bad it was. Cornelius Tacitus, Roman historian, governor. Hence, to suppress the rumor, he falsely charged with guilt and punished with the most exquisite tortures of persons commonly called Christians, who were hated for their enormities. Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius. What Cornelius is saying here was to stop this mass craziness. They punished with exquisite tortures Christians that had risen up, and they were hated for their what? Enormity. There was such a vast number of them that had sprung up. They were hated, and they were being tortured and killed by the government, and nobody could extinguish them. But it was all based on a lie. The proof is historically and in testimony overwhelming. In Roman and Jewish cultures, usually through clenched teeth in their documentation, had to admit it was true. Not one historical writing from either party ever tried to refute what I've told you today. And we had hundreds of eyewitnesses that accepted the accounts as authentic because they saw it. And all this occurred in spite of the fact that 16-plus Roman well-trained fighters guarded. So, I bring it down to this. Dr. Simon Greenleaf, royal, listen to the credential as though it means something, but to the secular world it does. Because I do not want you to think that I went out and found a bunch of nice little Christians to back my story. I want you to know that the people that are in this business, I'm nobody. The people that are in this business, the people that you don't hear from because they're removed by the media, but the people that actually handle these things and know what they're talking about versus the media that wants to play what they want, the people you really need to research that have done the research, these people are the ones that I want you to know are who we went to get this information. Thereby, I want you to know his credential. Dr. Simon Greenleaf is the famous royal professor of law at Harvard University. He's responsible for the rise of Harvard to its eminent position today. Did you get that? He's the one that made Harvard what it is today. He's top dog, big banana, big kahuna, bad dude, top gun, maverick. We'll stop there. He's the man. Here's what he says. According to the laws of legal evidence used in courts of law, there is more evidence for the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ than for just about any other event in what class? History. Using the same criteria he uses in Harvard Law School, the most documented fact in all of history is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Zeitgeist, take that and shove it in your TV tubes. It irritates me a little bit. To the informed person, to the informed person, there's simply no reason that can be found not to believe that Jesus Christ is who he said he was. Unless you simply choose not to believe. The most important question that you will ever decide was asked 2,000 years ago. And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" When the man that brought Harvard to its pinnacle can take the very laws of our court system and apply them to the historical, archaeological, testimonial evidence and tell you that the most proven fact that you could have in history according to the courts of law is the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you still want to sit here and question? It's not an intellectual argument anymore. You don't want to believe because you'd rather live your life the way you want. You'd rather give up the most awesome, most beautiful, most purposeful relationship you could ever have. Your whole reason for having breath in your lungs, He created you. You'd rather dismiss all of that. But don't you dare one more time dismiss it as an intellectual suicide. You dismiss it and dismiss it for the fact that you don't want Him. No other reason. And that's fine. I can handle that. Because that's your choice between you and Jesus. But don't you dare come and tell me that I'm intellectually stupid for believing in Jesus Christ. Because all the evidence, my friend, is in my court. Because God the Father wouldn't let you believe something that you couldn't prove. But society will hide that fact from you. You go and you research everything that you've seen. I'll give you the notes so you can have the footnotes. It's there. I'm not worried about what you find. This is what I want to tell you. This world has gone nuts. And it's going to hell in a handbasket. And there is no purpose for life anymore. And everybody's crazy. And nobody really loves. And you go around looking for a reason to be happy and looking for something to give you some form of purpose, and you got none. And we're self-destructing left and right, and we feel no real love from anything. And you busy yourself with all this stuff, and you miss the most awesome purpose in life. Someone that loved you enough to go through what I just told you. Oh my gosh. Jesus Christ, God, loved you enough to go through what I just told you. And die like a worm. Why? Not to command you like Hercules. But to be your beloved. To be your best friend. To be down on our level and hug and embrace us and say He wants a relationship with us. Every time you pick up an ant or a grasshopper or a flower or see a sunset or breathe the air or taste that ice cream, it's a gift from Jesus Christ saying, I love you. I created life for you. I want to razzle dazzle you. You are my beloved. You have a purpose. Let's be together. And you want to say, nah, I've got much more important things here. Here's the deal. And I'll close with this. If you want to follow that path, I know where it's going to lead you. But I'm telling you, the world's getting too crazy too fast. When you are hit with this kind of truth, you better decide what you believe. Because if you don't, Satan is the great salesman. If you take truth and you don't act on it, Satan will take it away and he'll convince you and he'll pull you with all the sins he can throw at you and he'll just make you go your way. If you can hear what I just told you and hear that God came down, hung on a cross naked with His skin torn off His back and spit on His face and died as a worm to love you, and you're going to be ashamed of Him, you don't deserve Him. But if you can accept the fact of what I just told you and you can see how awesomely He loves you, and He's not some big gray-haired lightning bolt Zeus God, but He is a beloved, exciting, awesome, creative, sacrificial, humble man that adores you. And you can't give your heart to Him in trust and find a new purpose in life. I don't know what else to tell you. But I can tell you, even when you say no to Him after all that, you don't make Him mad, you break His heart. I am begging you, open your heart and listen to what I've told you and give this man what he's asking for. How much more could you hear? How much more love could he possibly show you? How much more proof could he put in your hand? How can you still deny him? If you don't know him, give him the honor of making this the day that you're not ashamed of him anymore. And if you still don't want him after this, why don't you just decide you don't want him and go live life to the fullest extent that hell will accept you? But he is everything. Give him a try. Satan will take you back. Let's close in prayer.